Iran's top military commander says that the U.S. and several Arab states involved in the assassination of General Soleimani should be held accountable for their crime. Thousands of anti-government protesters rally in Georgia after the arrest of an opposition leader, deepening the country's political crisis. Official data indicates Britain's unemployment rate increased dramatically in the final quarter of last year in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, starting with Iran, the country is saying that all those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani must be held accountable. Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces, General Bagheri, says that the killing was a blatant crime and an act of state terrorism. He said that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Jordan, and Kuwait abetted the U.S. in its assassination. The general stressed that all those who helped Washington commit such a crime must be held into account. He said American planes targeted Soleimani's vehicle with armor-piercing weapons. General Soleimani and his senior Iraqi commander were killed in a U.S. drone attack near Iraqi capital Baghdad in January last year. Now, political analyst Laith Madrov says that Iran should keep raising the assassination case of General Soleimani until the West and its regional allies admit to their crime.
What is expected that Iran will keep on raising the stakes until either the international community, what we call the international community, the Western powers, admit that there was a war crime committed, a crime against humanity of assassinating somebody in an airport on an official peace mission. So this should put all those who aided the United States in this assassination at notice, and they should be very clear that the retaliation will come. If any country has American bases in it, it is an occupied country. It means that country doesn't have any sovereignty specifically with its foreign policies. It is a vessel, and definitely that is true of all the Gulf countries and Jordan that were mentioned in the list of countries that were aided the assassination of Soleimani. But the threat put forward by the general for holding those countries responsible should notify them that it doesn't matter that you're a vessel, that you're just doing what your master is telling you. You will still be held responsible for those crimes.
Almost 33 years after the end of the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, Tehran is still seeking legal ways to bring to justice those who helped Saddam Hussein kill thousands of innocent Iranians with weapons of mass destruction. Houman Abadi has attended an event in which high-ranking officials told of their efforts to take action against Western countries that armed the former Iraqi dictator with unconventional weapons.
The passage of time will never let the world forget the war crimes former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein committed against the innocent Iranian people. As part of its heinous crimes, the Iraqi dictator bombarded northwestern city of Sardash in 1978, killing 119 innocent civilians and exposing more than 8,000 to toxic gases, which maimed them forever. But Saddam was not alone in this 8-year war, and there were several countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the US, that assisted him by arming his regime by chemical weapons. The Islamic Republic has always stressed that those complicit in Saddam's war crimes must be brought to justice. Therefore, in the presence of the country's top officials, an international conference was held in Tehran to look into the legal and international claims of the Islamic Republic in this regard.
Many countries gave Saddam intelligence, political, economic, military, and media support. All the world witnessed that these countries all stood against the great nation of Iran, but the United Nations could not play its role. The UN did not declare the Iraqi regime as the aggressor and the perpetrator of war. This is the question that the international community must ask the UN. Why the Security Council did not stop the aggressor from committing crimes against the Islamic Republic.
In the face of the chemical attacks, the international community turned down Tehran's frequent requests for deployment of experts for field investigations, something that Iran's foreign minister blasted during this event.
The Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and non-civilians, and also the Iraqi people. In 6 or 7 reports by the United Nations, it was declared that the chemical weapons were first used against military forces and then civilians. But the United Nations does not have a good record in supporting international law, and during the imposed war, it did not even use the means to make power balance.
It was also stressed at this conference that the assassination of the former Iranian IRGC Quds Force commander General Qasem Soleimani is top on the agenda to be followed up as part of this plan. Thinkers and researchers from 17 countries presented their papers on the legal aspects of the imposed war on Iran. These experts, in both virtual and in-person methods, elaborated on how the foreign countries helped Saddam's regime in killing civilians. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Thousands of anti-government protesters have rallied in Georgia against the arrest of a key opposition leader, deepening the country's political crisis. Supporters of Nika Melia gathered around this party's headquarters in the capital, Tbilisi. Hundreds of riot police used tear gas to disperse them. People hit the streets after senior opposition figures called for a peaceful struggle to defend Georgian democracy. Melia was arrested. In an overnight police raid, he's been placed in pretrial detention. The country has been in turmoil since last year's parliamentary elections, which saw the ruling party score a narrow win. The opposition claims that a vote was rigged. Based on official data, Britain's unemployment climbed to its highest rate in almost 5 years. In the final quarter of 2020, the Office for National Statistics says that unemployment rate edged up to 5.1% in the fourth quarter of last year. And that happened as COVID lockdowns slashed economic activity in the UK. The government has spoken of plans to support employment. However, analysts expect joblessness to surge at the end of April. And that's when the government's furlough scheme paying the bulk of wages for millions of private sector workers comes to an end. The UK is one of the hardest hit European states by the pandemic. Mina Taylor says that there are many British firms that are waiting to see the effects of the vaccination plan before they decide to hire new people.
What is clear is that even though these figures, this 5.1% you mentioned there, is terrible news for the Exchequer, who've been hemorrhaging money. I mean, this furlough scheme has cost, nearly £47 billion just up until now. So the Treasury is desperate to kind of claw back some revenues. But I think a lot of firms are waiting. They're waiting to see how this vaccination drive pans out before they decide whether or not to hire new people. And one thing we do know that COVID would have done here would have been to change the job market, well, as we know it, in terms of working from home and more remote opportunities. So even though it's terrible, terrible news at the moment, and the government have put all their economic eggs in this vaccination drive basket, if Boris Johnson's four-point plan in getting the economy back on its feet through this series of easing up on lockdowns, I think companies will feel a little bit more clear in terms of navigating the future.
It's news review time. Do stay with us. The United Nations has warned of surging hunger levels across most of Central America in the midst of the coronavirus crisis and extreme weather conditions. The World Food Program says that nearly 8 million people are now facing hunger in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And that's nearly a four-fold increase compared to 2018. The UN agency says that some 1.7 million people are in the region, also in urgent need of food assistance. It added that hurricanes last November seriously impacted the lives of nearly 7 million people in the region, with many losing their homes and livelihoods. The hurricanes came as people there were already reeling from the COVID-19 pandemic. Okay, I'll invite a couple of guests and let's see what they think about the situation, what can be done. So we'll have David Barkin, professor of economics at the Metropolitan Autonomous University, joining us out of Mexico City, and also Jan Endego, writer and global equality activist out of Philadelphia. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to David in Mexico City. David, you know, the situation in those countries you just mentioned, they've been suffering from hunger, and now we have here in the support since 2018, it's only a couple of years, and then we have fourfold this problem, hunger problem, you know, getting worse. What could be responsible for this?
I think that the major responsibility for this is twofold. One, the lack of responsibility of the governments in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua to really confront the problem, to support the peasant communities, the food-producing communities, and the absolute lack of responsibility in the face of military repression of rural communities throughout the whole region. That's on the one hand. Mm-hmm. On the other hand is the United States' absolute washing its hands, absolute forgetting about the fact that over the years, United States military aid, United States political aid, has created a structure within these countries that has led to the government's inability to respond and unwillingness to respond to the needs of the people in all of these countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, turning to Philadelphia, Jana, you know that strong countries, strong economies actually, on top of the U.S., unfortunately, and China and some others, they're the biggest polluters, and they're making, you know, the world not a better place to live. And still, and they're also claiming they're, you know, giving a lot of lip service regarding, I call it lip service because that's what I'm going to ask you, because they talk about human rights, democracy, you know, equality and all that. So why shouldn't they foot the bill and help these countries like Nicaragua and El Salvador?
Well, the, you know, and speaking specifically about the U.S. As an individual leaders here, and, you know, in the Western, the connection of the Western nations through the EU, NATO, axis of domination, there's the capitalist system and the imperialist system upon which these nations are founded and have grown to power. Is one of extraction, and it really seeks to build the wealth, the consistent wealth of a small group of individuals perpetually and at any cost and at any expense. It's not a community-based economy, and so if there is not profit to be made for in the act of helping people, then it's not a part of the business of the U.S. And so while there is the conversation around human rights and the protection of human rights and democracy and freedom, those are all narratives that are used in order to justify acts of aggression against states that are actually seeking to build human rights and to take care of the basic needs of the individuals in their communities, because that often will cost the more wealthy class of people the value or the benefit of being able to exploit the resources of that particular land. Alternatively, if that is not an issue, and if there is nothing that relates to the business as usual extraction that's at stake, then the U.S. doesn't demonstrate any desire to actually provide support. And that happens even in our own nation, where we saw, going back to what happened in Louisiana and New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, up right. to what's going on in Texas today, that there is not a prioritization of the needs of human beings or of what the planet needs. The what's prioritized is the ability for capitalists to gain more capital and to maintain power.
Okay, interesting. Now, Professor Barkin, what's the real solution to such woes? I mean, humanitarian and philanthropic assistance? Or, let's say, isn't it better for countries like the U.S., for instance, to stop interfering in those countries' affairs? You remember El Salvador, Nicaragua, the regime change and all that, coup d'etats, whatever, they've been always doing this thing. Isn't that a better idea for Washington to stop such policies and let those people breathe freely and take care of their own problems instead of offering humanitarian supplies?
Well, I think you're perfectly correct. You've hit the nail on the head. The humanitarian assistance through the World Food Program, which you mentioned in the introduction, is only a band-aid, is only a short-term inadequate process of trying to deliver some minuscule amounts of aid in comparison to the needs of the people. And unfortunately, in these countries that you're mentioning, much of this aid is actually channeled off into the middle classes, and even in some cases, the upper classes, as my colleague and the other commentator was saying. The problem that you have identified is not that the United States is not just that the United States should stop intervening, but that the United Nations would have to intervene directly to provide political support for a respect of the political parties and the social groups that are trying to rebalance the political forces. You've
right.
had coup d'etat, soft and hard, golpe de estados, coup d'etat in all four countries
mm-hmm.
in one way or another over the past years, which have led to a dramatic decline in the quality of life and in an increase in murders, in military actions, but also an absolute disrespect for the environmental conditions which would be necessary for the countries to retake the road to food self-sufficiency.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Unfortunately, that's all the time we had. Let me thank our guests. We had David Barkin, Professor of Economics with Metropolitan Autonomous University out of Mexico City, and Yana Ndego, writer and global equality activist from Philadelphia. And that's it for this edition of the News Review. Let's move on. Afghanistan has launched its COVID vaccination campaign aimed at inoculating hundreds of thousands. Doctors, security personnel, and journalists were among the first volunteers to receive the shots. President Ashraf Ghani says that 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca COVID vaccines will be used in the first stage. They were donated by India earlier this month. Afghanistan has officially registered 55,600 COVID infections and 2,400 deaths. The real numbers are believed to be much higher, as limited testing has hampered efforts to track the virus. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
The wealthy, privileged whites served by the Texas dominant political class are a small minority of the population. That's the ongoing legacy of conquest and colonialism, says Scott Kirsch, university professor, in an article published under the heading "White Supremacy Set the Stage for Texas' Miserable Disaster Response." Stay tuned for the details, please. In order to make sense of the natural and human-induced disaster that has struck Texas, the nation will first need an accurate picture of who lives here. Yes, Texas has its oil barons, fossil fuel lobbyists, and opportunistic political leaders who have extracted wealth from the state at the expense of the environment and human needs. But the real figure that should stand out is 17 million people. That's roughly the Latino, Black, Indigenous, and Asian population of Texas, which comprises nearly 60% of the state. Only three states and 69 countries have a larger total population. Denmark, Finland, and Norway combined do not total 17 million residents. Of the 13 cities in the U.S. with populations above 900,000 today, five are in Texas, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, and Fort Worth, and only 25 to 48% non-Hispanic whites. Thus, any story of Texans freezing, dying, or hospitalized from carbon monoxide poisoning, losing power for vital medical equipment, or suffering without water or pipes bursting is more than likely occurring among states' BIPOC majority. Outrage has erupted in Texas and throughout the U.S., perhaps building on the momentum of the 2020 uprisings against the white supremacy and police-perpetrated violence. Coming on the heels of the Trump-fueled mob attack on the Capitol and GOP refusal to hold the former president accountable, the catastrophe in Texas may be similar to the many 100-year or 500-year events that have now become commonplace. Floods, wildfires, freezes, and heat waves wreak havoc today, but provide a preview of much worse effects to come from the compounded effects of industrial pollution and capitalist consumption. As a result, three long-overshadowed problems are now being widely discussed. First, after the popular revolts of 1960s, global powers responded with new liberal restructuring designed to heighten the free reign of capital while weakening the collective power of workers and unions. Second, Governor Greg Abbott's spurious scapegoating of renewable energy for the power outages, a perfect exposition of what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism, has escalated demands for a Green New Deal. More broadly, it has exposed the need for an immediate and transformative response to the climate crisis rooted in principles of climate justice that empower and uplift people in the global south and the most oppressed sectors of the global north bearing the brunt of the crisis. Third, Ted Cruz's "Let Them Eat Cake" vacation to Cancun was a visible reminder of the cruelty of U.S. political system, a system that rewards politicians propped up by corporate money, right-wing lies, and racist ideologies for blaming others and evading responsibility. The elites most responsible for the disastrous effects of climate change, racism, ableism, and poverty would have Americans believe that it is always others who must suffer instead of their own families. The policies that have caused death and suffering have not failed. They have worked exactly as intended. The exponential growth of the billionaire class has been a direct product of 5 decades of neoliberalism, but the gains for the working and middle classes have been deliberately illusory. Yet, there can be no innocent return to the era of liberalism and the New Deal. We need to appreciate from history how problems illuminated now in Texas are interconnected with the decline of the white majority and the liberal order. The wealthy and privileged whites served by Texas' dominant political class are a small minority of the population. That's the ongoing legacy of conquest and colonialism. Seen in this light, the unnecessary human suffering and the death during the current catastrophe, whose full effects may not be known for some time, connect Texas to New Orleans and Flint, where short-term economic and political expediency have combined with racist, classist, and ableist dehumanization to render mass populations disposable before, during, and after natural and human-induced disasters. This is how the bifurcation of Herrenvolk democracy is now playing out. We are simultaneously moving toward a new social order that fulfills real democracy and a world system driven by master race ideology, a researcher said. In Texas, where new and sustainable infrastructure is desperately needed, the New Deal has been supplanted by conspiracy theories and political Ponzi schemes. Like deregulated energy rates, these schemes promise cost savings at the expense of long-term stability and security, ultimately drowning households and local governments in debt while the Dow reaches record highs. What is conceivable with the empowerment of a new majority in Texas and everywhere? The U.S. needs structural change in politics to sweep away the politicians controlled by big money and dependent on lies, climate denial, and scapegoating to remain in power. We all saw what Trump was able to get away with, and his legacy continues through the likes of Cruz and Abbott. But we also know that these crises are not limited to red states, and that Democratic policies have generally been inadequate, even as bolder and more promising proposals and leaders linked to activist movements have begun to arise and challenge the party's establishment. As Grace Lee Boggs recognized the growing illegitimacy of dominant institutions, she taught Americans that the only way to survive is by taking care of one another. That doesn't mean Americans should let those in power off the hook. What it implies is that Americans must do more than protest. Americans must look to grassroots organizers, indigenous peoples, and women of color for solidarity in this transitional era of systematic collapse. In recent years, movements at Standing Rock and Monarchy have responded to colonial disintegration by projecting a future centered on earth, water, and life across the U.S. Doc Review.
and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Embargo, directed by Jerry Rice. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Robey, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph and who's also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and Radio 4's film programme. And beside him, we are also joined by Cuba expert Dr. Helen Yaffe, who is a lecturer at the University of Glasgow and has also written a book about Che Guevara's economic policies. Now, Embargo chronicles the story of the politics and collusion behind the Cuban embargo, its history, impact, and evolution, along with information from recently declassified documents and high-profile interviews. This film gives a unique perspective dating back before the 1959 Cuban Revolution that put Fidel Castro to power and led to the failed CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion and 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis. The film's compelling truths ultimately link the threads of an untold history and become the film's core message to end the embargo and looks to a future of rebuilding diplomatic and economic relations.
My father spent most of the 13 days in the White House, and he said that we had to be good soldiers and show up at school, that if there was a nuclear war, that none of us would want to be around afterwards.
Each small mistake would bring us to the confrontation. My father repeated, if we lose control, we will not be in charge.
Dad virtually told me nothing about Cuba. When Castro came in to overthrow Batista, my father must have been pretty thrilled, actually. You know, because you could remember Batista was not such a great guy.
We've been lied to since 1959 about Cuba, and we're still being lied to today. This unholy alliance between Nixon, the Mafia, and the CIA still impacting us today.
At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity that was not approved at the highest level.
We made it United States policy to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Wow, this is not what we bargained for. We just thought we were going to get rid of a corrupt government.
The president held out an olive leaf to Castro, and he said to him, the United States history in Cuba has been a history of atrocities, and we understand that we're going to have to pay for that in one way or another.
Now, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this is a film that takes a critical look at the U.S.'s trade ban on Cuba and the political turmoil between the two countries. And it also features lots of generous footage of archive footage and high-profile interviews with historical figures and celebrities alike. And Tim, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, the subject is fascinating and has been thorny and, you know, much contested for, 60 years now. My feeling is that the subject deserves a more incisive treatment than this film, and one which is more analytical and more focused on what it's trying to achieve. For me, it feels like a kind of fairly skimpy overview. It's like a kind of whistle-stop tour of Cuba's sort of greatest hit historically since the 50s, which sort of lets you sort of land on the big moments, but doesn't really explain them. I mean, there are little nuggets of interest along the way, and some of the interviews do reveal things, but I felt that in general there was quite a lack of kind of intelligence around the film.
It surely is a huge subject with lots of layers, and perhaps for audiences who are not familiar with this issue, it serves as a good introduction to the subject. Helen, if I could turn to you, as someone who spent many years in Cuba and studied Cuba, what was your take on this documentary?
I think precisely for the reasons that you're saying, it's a good, engaging documentary. It has that historical overview, which I guess that, you know, when you've studied Cuba, you know that history, you sort of take it for granted that others do. But it provides that. There's some great archival image. There's really good interviews. My only issue with it is that because it was called Embargo, I was hoping to see more focus on the embargo and, you know, the series of laws that were introduced at different points by different presidents in the United States and the impact that they've had on the Cuban people and on the rest of the world because of the extraterritorial nature of the embargo. But as a sort of general introduction, it didn't offer anything particularly new or novel, but it was, you know, some nice material and a good reminder of, you know, that relationship between the United States and Cuba. I do think that there were areas where more analysis would have been useful. Why was the United States so hostile against the Cuban Revolution? What was it that they were doing that was so unacceptable to the US power structure? So more on...
That's precisely the questions, actually, I'd like to ask you a bit later on.
The major premise of the American blockade of Cuba is to starve the Cuban people into submission or rebellion. It is a violation of all moral and legal standards to use the starvation of people as a foreign policy tool.
Well, the embargo was originally intended to wreak havoc in Cuba and create instability. There's no two ways around that. In 1965, Johnson then added food, for now part of the official embargo, and then medicine was also added as well.
I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue.
If a financial transaction takes place with American dollars abroad and an American bank is involved, that transaction is illegal. If a ship docks in Cuba to let off supplies that have been purchased legally by Cuba, that ship may not then proceed to an American port. It is a blockade that is unilateral only because no one else in the world wants to join the United States in this insane policy, but it is so extraterritorial in nature that it involves other countries whether they like it or not.
So Tim, the documentary argues that the embargo fails both the US and Cuba. What were the reasons laid out in the film for this?
Well, it's a little vague. This section of the film is the bit that deals with the embargo probably most fully. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be fleshed out a lot more. It dates back to a whole history of kind of government antipathy between Fidel Castro and a succession of American presidents. And we see them sort of ticked off one by one, if you like, mm-hmm. and the relationship just deteriorates. I mean, it's pretty bad with Kennedy, and it just gets worse and worse. By George W. Bush, it's really shocking. Mm-hmm. I really thought that the film could have focused on that entirely, and that would have been a very valid approach. Instead, we get a lot of other bits and bobs of kind of other sort of facets of Cuban kind of politics and history. Mm-hmm. Anyone who hasn't visited Cuba might struggle to kind of get the hang of the politics there and to get the hang of what a complicated country it is, and the complicated relationship between the people of Cuba and Castro in his day, and also between Cuban Americans and Castro, who had quite a hostile relationship to him. The film does bring all of that up, and I was, you know, in some ways grateful to be reminded of some of those things. So yeah, it was interesting to delve back into all of this subject. I've been to Cuba myself, and it reminded me of a lot that I learned when I was there.
A good point that you raise, actually. There is a lot of propaganda against Cuba, so this film perhaps serves as a good counter-narrative to that propaganda.
It does, up to a point. I sort of felt that sometimes it was being a bit sketchy about the specifics. I think there's some statistic that among imported goods into Cuba, still quite a lot comes from the USA, something between 6 to 7%, something like that. And you would think from this film that it was an absolute 0% blockade. So that kind of detail gets a little bit elided, I think, in the narrative.
And Helen, if I could turn to you now to shed more light on the embargo itself. Mm. It seems like from the documentary that the US was the only country in the world that had a problem with Cuba. And why were the reasons for this, and were they justified?
So after the revolution, it wasn't declared as socialist straight away. There was a period where there was tit-for-tat retaliations between the United States government and the Cuban government. So the process of nationalizations didn't take place until almost 2 years after the triumph of the revolution. And at the point where the Cuban government started to nationalize, they offered the foreign companies compensation based on the value that they had claimed their businesses were for tax purposes. And Canadian companies, French companies, they took the compensation. So that settled the claim. But in the United States, the Eisenhower government had told U.S. companies not to accept compensation. Why? Because they were already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion, which obviously is inconceivable to them that it wouldn't work and they wouldn't be able to throw out the nascent revolutionary government. So that was, you know, the opportunity there was to resolve those issues. And subsequently, the U.S. blockade or embargo, depending on who's speaking, has been, you know, it's the pretext has been it's a punishment for these nationalizations, but the reality has been it's always been at the center of a larger program which is trying to achieve regime change in Cuba.
And Tim, how damaging was the embargo? The film touches on this quite a bit. To Cuban society and what effect did it have as laid out in the documentary?
Well, yeah, it creates a kind of big divide in Cuba. I don't feel the doc really does enough of that, actually. And there are a lot of comparisons, interesting comparisons that could be made between kind of the American the welfare state and the Cuban welfare state, for instance, which the film just doesn't bother with. There are pros and cons of Cuban culture and life that I feel are left out. But I think perhaps what it would have been much better as is a much more focused one on just the embargo.
And Helen, the embargo itself, instead of Cuba falling down to it, actually, were they able to survive and not only that, thrive?
They were able to survive, and you know, let's be clear, in the initial period, that was thanks to the help from the Soviet Union. As you said, I focused my work on Che Guevara's economics, and you know, he had a dream. He was in charge of industrialization, of taking the most advanced technology in the world and implementing that in Cuba, but of course that was cut off, because immediately the US government was contacting the Prime Minister of Britain and saying, you cannot sell equipment or transport, you know, or anything to Cuba. So they had a very extensive trade. By the time that the Soviet bloc collapsed, 85% of Cuba's trade took place with that part of the world. And so, you know, in a sense, that trade had protected Cuba from the US blockade, from the impact of the embargo, because it didn't affect that trade. It could still carry out. The Soviet Union, Eastern Germany, and so on weren't going to pay any attention. But the double whammy of the blockade was felt then in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And that's when Cuba entered something called a special period in time of peace. And that was my first experience of living in Cuba was in the 1990s. And, you know, it was extraordinarily hard. Even if you had dollars, you know, there was the pharmacies were empty, you know, food shops were empty, equipment just lay abandoned because they couldn't get the spare parts.
So the embargo was affecting the lives of everyday Cubans.
We made it, United States policy, to assassinate Fidel Castro. This was our policy, to bring down the Cuban government.
By the summer of 1959, the CIA is working with some mobsters to try and kill Fidel Castro. Nixon just ordered the CIA to ratchet up their plots with the mafia. Pretty audacious plan. It's now been very well documented, but only in the last two or three years when the National Archives found some files that really helped to lay some of this stuff out for the first time.
Dr. Castro, an American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America.
When am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody.
Someone who's not familiar with this subject, some of these revelations in the documentary might seem like a bombshell, really. And you would think some of these things were conspiracy theories, these plots to take down Castro. Tim, were you surprised by this and by some of the findings and evidence of the documentary?
I wasn't really surprised because I've seen some of the films about Castro, for instance, and Oliver Stone made a film about him, and I've read books on the subject. This film does come down rightly very hard on the CIA and kind of presents it as sort of a banker-funded mafia with its own interests in the stock market at heart. And you see that the kind of successive attempts of the CIA to kind of unsettle the Castro regime and unseat him. And it goes as far as assassination attempts. But again, I would love to have seen much more specific evidence of that. You could really go into the details on that and kind of deal with it. We get sort of a little bit of documentation, but really not very much. I feel as though it's the makings of a really compelling kind of conspiracy-themed doc on that subject, which is rather very different from the doc about the embargo that we're sometimes getting as well. So they kind of sit side by side a little bit uneasily. I did find that section of the film kind of picked up the pace a little bit. I'll give it that.
It was incredibly exciting and fascinating, actually, this part of the documentary. And Helen, if I could turn to you, just going back about the assassination attempts on Castro. I mean, according to another documentary, 638 Ways
which
to
I was
Kill
gonna mention,
Castro,
yeah.
Fabian Escalante claims that there have been over 600 times attempts on Castro's life over a span of 40 years.
Yeah.
Why were there so many attempts, and then why did they fail?
I think two things are important. One is that the US government has never understood what a revolution means in the sense that they have such a sort of personalized politics. They felt like taking out Fidel would destroy what was a mass movement, a revolution. And secondly, because of what he represented, and that's another element I think is missing, you know, the fact that Cuba was able to implement free universal healthcare, education, access to culture and so on. And what does that say in exposing the US model where they say, you know, you have to pay for healthcare and if you don't, you're left to die in the street. So, you know, really the biggest threat that Cuba presented was not the Soviet missiles that were there in 1962, but the biggest threat was the sort of threat of an alternative form of development. And that's what, you know, the US was so afraid of contaminating the rest of Latin America.
And Tim, if I could turn to you, would you have any thoughts to add to what Helen just said involving the film?
On the subject of this spreading to Latin American domino theory stuff, I guess, that's an interesting one as well. And yeah, the degree to which Cuba could be a kind of like a ringleader in that sense. There are films about that as well, and there are films about the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically.
Yeah.
There's 13 days is mentioned, the 13 days in which it
perhaps happened. What's unique about this documentary then, as by first-time filmmaker Jerry Rice, is that she was so taken by this subject and she involves herself in the journey. So from the perspective of sort of the layman's point of view, this takes you on that journey also.
It does. She starts off as quite a presence in the film, and you kind of get have the sense of her kind of journeying there and this conversation that she had with Castro on a bus. And then she sort of drops out of it, and it sort of tries to become a bit more of an overview. And she kind of comes back in a little bit at the end. But I don't want to be overly negative because there are things of value here. But I feel as though the film is indecisive about whether it's a personal treatise on Cuba and on the embargo, or if it's more of a kind of impersonal overview of the subject. I think it never quite makes its mind up, and you can kind of sense the vagueness in it because sometimes the film will transition from one subject area into another. A little bit of music thrown in just to kind of help us over the bumps. I felt as though there needed to be much more of a sense of structure. Perhaps she started the film too early and hasn't got enough material from the last couple of years. There have been a lot of changes, as we'll talk about. And perhaps what it's missing is that most recent stuff that would really have helped kind of build the argument a bit more forcefully.
I
think even in terms of the embargo, I mean, you know, people are talking about it in the past tense. Especially since Obama announced rapprochement with Cuba.
President Trump will treat the Castro regime as a malevolent dictatorship that it is. Thank you, President Trump. You have not betrayed us. You kept your promise. I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana.
And you mark my words. And you mark my words. Whether it's in 6 months or 6 years, Cuba will be free.
We just didn't fight hard enough. Now, those days are over. Now we hold the cards. We now hold the cards. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
And Helen, as I noticed, you're shaking your head at Marco Rubio. Why was that?
Marco Rubio has some leverage over Trump, and he seems to be playing the tune that Trump is dancing to at present. It's worth pointing, as a businessman, Trump sent his representatives to talk to the Cuban government about business opportunities in 1998, when it still was illegal before rapprochement, and also in the early 2000s. So Trump, with his businessman hat on, had, you know, said, I have no problem with lifting the embargo. And in fact, he said that at the beginning of his electoral campaign. But obviously, when he became a serious candidate, he had to do the done thing and go to Miami and win the support of the Rubios and the other Cuban-American politicians. And he obviously, you know, made deals with them.
And of course, Florida was a turning point in the election for Trump winning. Tim, if I could turn to you, how was Trump portrayed in this documentary, and is he shown as responsible for reigniting the hostility between the US and Cuba?
He is shown as doing that in that clip, which is pretty much the last 2 minutes of the film. That is it, what we've just seen. That's the only time we see Trump. What strikes me about that clip is that it's cut like a trailer. It was incredibly fast, and the footage was just flowing in. The music's really hammering this out. You could watch a 90-minute film just on that. And instead, we end with this kind of rapid-fire trailer montage of the harm that Trump has done. It really is all too hasty, I think. I wanted commentary on that. I wanted people talking about that. I wanted analysis of that. Instead, we just see his speech. We see it happening. And then we kind of go home and hope that things change.
But there's only so much time, I suppose, you can cram into a documentary.
Of course, yeah. But I just feel as though it's biting off more than it can chew, fundamentally. And I think if it had just focused a bit more, I think we would have a more valuable film.
I just want to add, I mean, you know, like, under the Obama administration, there were more fines against third countries and companies in third countries.
But, of course, wasn't Obama trying to ease relations with Havana?
He did too little too late. The U.S. embargo blockade is codified in U.S. law. It can only be lifted by a vote in Congress. But as the president, he could issue executive decrees. And those he did issue on very limited basis to allow, you know, six airlines to fly from the United States to Cuba and a couple of hotels. But he could have gone far further, and he didn't. And in fact, you know, under Obama, some of the fines were astonishingly high. So the French bank Paribas was fined nearly $9 billion for, you know, interactions with financial interactions, not just with Cuba, also with Sudan and Iran. And then, you know, the fines are just endless. If you read the Cuban motion to the United Nations General Assembly when they have their annual vote, it will list some of the fines, and they go up right to the end of the Obama administration. So it was a very sort of two-sided coin. Exactly.
I'm afraid I'd love to talk more on this topic, but we've run out of time on the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.